listening to a podcast of Living Faith located at 51 North Market Street, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a community of faith, love, and hope.
If I was a Pharisee, I would probably believe that I knew what God wanted you to know. I knew what he wanted to say, and I wouldn't be worried. I would just tell you what I think and believe that it was God's word. I don't believe that. I'm just grateful. I feel like that I've been successful if a number of you actually went through and read Esther this week. So I feel like in that regard, I've been successful, but I am still going to stay and talk. So I'm glad that you read it. Afterwards, whenever I finish my part of the story, I would like to take some time, if there are things that you catch in my story or things that you caught while you read that perhaps you want to mention, things that stood out to you, things you hadn't realized. I'm especially interested in things that maybe you missed in Sunday school, because I kind of call this part of my Monday school stories. So if it's something that you thought that just ended up being completely different and it just stood out to you, I'm especially interested in that. But anything that you might have caught, questions you might have, we can talk about them afterwards. I think that would be great. Does anybody remember what I said was probably the most important message for us to take away from Esther? Considering all of the violence in the story, all of the uncertainty, the trying circumstances, does anybody remember what I said? Really, the big primary purpose of this story probably would be for us. It's something that Jewish scholars have used the story to teach to their people as well. And that's that God's providence is something that exists. God is powerful. And whenever he said to Abraham that he was going to use him to bring redemption and to bring his promise to fruition, that he meant it. And it really didn't matter what men tried to do. If the whole world came against his plan would still happen. And that's really the message of Esther. You know, it's not a story that tells us we should pick up our swords and run out and fight people who hate us. It's a message that we have to trust that God will see his message and his promise to completion. Does anyone remember where we stopped 3 weeks ago whenever I was telling the story? It was a wonderful fairy tale moment. It was a perfect place to end the story. Esther had just become the queen. She won the beauty pageant the way we saw it in Sunday school, at least I did. And now she was the queen and everything was great and they all lived happily, happily ever after. So we'll just pick up sometime a little bit after that. My queen, may we proceed? Haggai asked gently, gesturing toward the doors ahead. Esther started. She had been lost in wonder. There were dozens of towering crimson columns, taller than trees, standing around her. Square shafts of light poured through from golden windows and the roof overhead, bringing the ocean blue horse heads to life that sat atop each of the columns. Yes, Haggai, we can continue. But what is this hall for? Well, I suppose only the one that it just served, he guessed. Esther tilted her head. I don't understand. Well, the throne room is through those doors. This room is really only used to stun the king's guests. It's best if they are properly bowed in humility before they enter that room. She timidly followed her guide as he strode toward the throne room. Her mind was still dizzy, overwhelmed with the events of the past weeks. Well, the past year, really. She had moved from her cousin's small home in the west quarter of Susa to the king's harem, ordered there by the king's decree in search of a new queen. She had spent a year preening and waiting with hundreds of other young virgins. If the king didn't choose you, preening and waiting would probably be all that filled your days for the rest of your life, until your skin turned tight and your bones shriveled. Then she had been taken to the king one night, and the king was taken with her. Now, after many banquets in the Apadana, Esther was beginning her new life as queen of the Persian Empire. Haggai, just a moment. Yes, my queen, he bowed as he turned. You were kind to me in the harem. I asked for you to instruct me on palace etiquette, but I would also like to ask you more. Would you serve as my advisor? Haggai dropped to his knees. My queen, of course. Yes, I would be honored to do whatever you ask. A few moments later, Haggai led Esther into the empty throne room. There were fewer columns, mostly around the outside of the room. Its ceiling reached just as high, however, and there was even more light, setting the jade and marble floors aglow. The throne stood in the central island of light. She had thought that it would be perhaps a tall chair, but the throne itself was practically the size of Mordecai's humble home. A platform of cedar beams and gold accents rose to about the height of her head, and it was ringed with blue rails, a Persian steed's head on each corner. Centered on this platform was indeed a tall chair, gold in color, with soft blue cushions and jewels of every color spilling down its sides. Esther stood, fascinated by the empty tableau. "Of course, my queen," Haggai said, breaking the spell, "we will likely never be in this room when he is. The king is, I mean." "No?" she turned to him. "No. No one is permitted to enter the throne room in the king's presence unless summoned by the king. Of course, if the kingdom were under attack, a general would risk entry to alert the king, but that could still mean the general's death if the king were in a bad mood." And he cast a knowing glance at her. The rich, lively gold and blue colors of the room quickly drained, and Esther felt fear grip her as she began breathing quickly. Haggai noted her change in mood. "Yes, my queen, this is not our place. Let's leave." Outside, Mordecai walked up to the gate separating his neighborhood from the next. "Good morning, gentlemen," he said. "Good morning," five men murmured, blinking in the bright sunrise. Two were young, about Mordecai's age, while the other three were old. In times of danger, neighborhood walls and gates helped the city defend against invaders. In peacetime, those gates served as unofficial meeting places for elders to resolve disputes and lead their community. Mordecai had served his neighborhood bordering the palace quarter as an elder. Not long after Esther became queen, he received a visit from Prime Minister Edmatha and was appointed by him as a palace official. This was a tremendous elevation in stature, one that he was sure Esther had requested. Now, he still liked to chat with those elders and stay abreast of community issues as he went by every day. "Quiet night?" he asked. The youngest one, Gobrius, replied, "Yes, we don't know of any issues to be expecting today. We still must decide to do what to do about that well, but that won't be settled for months." As chatter continued in a nearly perfect choreographed moment, they each reached into their satchels, pulled out a pipe, and settled into the shade for the day ahead. Just before Mordecai took leave of them for work, they heard shouting as a crowd moved towards them. The unlit pipes returned to their bags as they stood to answer the commotion. "This man owes me a year's field work, and now he refuses to pay," shouted one. "Your work was unsatisfactory. I could have hired a small child to do your work, Hebrew dog." At this comment, shouts erupted from supporters of both sides, as well as onlookers who simply had nothing better to do. Gobrius smiled. "With a little skill, we can make this last until lunchtime." Mordecai went into the palace to take his station, and the next few hours passed as the elders called for witnesses from both men. Just about lunchtime, there was no work left to do except make a decision in the matter. Mordecai returned outside to take his lunch. Nibbling on some figs, he decided to listen in. Uziel, the Hebrew field worker, had nearly a dozen men bear witness to his work, while Phrenaspa, the landholder, had one man swear in agreement with him. So it seemed certain that Uziel would get his money, until the moment Mordecai witnessed his growing discomfort with Persia come to life. "Well," Gobrius said as the others nodded, "considering that these witnesses and the worker are all foreigners, Jews in fact, of no station, their testimony should not move our decision. And seeing as the good Persian landholder, as well as his hired foreman, claim Uziel's work was poor, we should dismiss the claim." Mordecai felt a cold knife run through his heart. He had instructed Hadassah, his adopted daughter, to take the Persian name Esther, lest she give up her status as a Jew. And he had kept his identity wrapped up cleanly with the elders for years. But now, his heart paused for a moment as he made a decision. "I am a Jew," he said firmly, pressing his way tighter into the circle of elders. On the other side of the city, Haman stepped onto his porch and took in the bright day. His gardens all seemed to be in order, Nearly a dozen men were trimming and pruning as he watched. A servant was rolling large barrels of crystal clear water to replenish the thirsty reflecting pool. "Take this with us," he instructed as he handed a long blue robe to a house servant. It was trimmed in silver and carried the great seal of Persia in gold on its breast. He had ordered it made nearly 2 years ago, just as he was making his plans to work through the king's outer council and into a much more powerful position. Money helped his ambitions, sure, but he was always scheming and planning to make his next move. And so when a caravan of the king's gold disappeared near Persepolis, Haman made sure Admatha, the prime minister, took the fall for it. Today, Haman's family had seen that his route to the palace was lined with all manner of relatives, debtors, servants, and sycophants to cheer as he passed. He smiled. He could feel the weight of the kingdom in his hands, and he liked how it felt. Inside the throne room, Haman stepped forward when called. King Xerxes reached toward him with a scepter, then called him onto the platform. And atop the steps, he knelt as his servant draped the blue robe of the prime minister on his shoulders. On another day, on a cold, windy afternoon, Mordecai was rushing through the portico, outside the throne hall, urging palace servants to move a little more quickly. A storm was moving in, and the fine linen curtains and banners that hung outside when the king was in session would be destroyed if they didn't get them inside before the storm grew any stronger. When the task was finished, he opened the door into the hall, planning to cut through the forest of columns back to his station at the palace gate. As the bright day had quickly turned, no one had yet lit the lanterns and torches inside the hall, so he could barely see. "So much for shortcuts," he mumbled to himself as he turned to head back outside. But just before he could open the heavy door, he heard angry cursing passing through the hall. Hushed at first, but then louder as they found security in the dark, two of the king's eunuchs, Teresh and Bigthana, were clearly upset. "I have had it. First, he appoints that fool Haman as prime minister, and now our advice is barely tolerated. Teresh, Persia is doomed if we do not do something. You know how rash the king is." "Quiet," Bigthana practically shouted, then continued in a whisper, now only a column separating them from Mordecai. "We must take action, but we cannot talk about it here. Let's leave the palace, maybe the city, and set our plans. Then we can set the kingdom straight." Mordecai didn't move until he heard the great doors at the entrance open and close. With the storm, Esther wasn't expecting him to visit today for a walk in the gardens, but he went anyways. Sheltered inside from the fierce mountain winds, he told Esther of the plot. Over the next 2 days, Artabanus, the commander of the king's royal guards, chased down Bigthana and Teresh, finding them in possession of weapons and correspondence from Artabazan, the exiled brother of the king who claimed the throne for himself. The evening was approaching months later when Haman and his servants left the palace for his extravagant home. As he was carried on a finely decorated litter, he was troubled. On the morning when he had assumed the second most powerful position in all the world, by Persia's reckoning at least, he was hailed by crowds and cheers. But now, business just carried on as he passed by. As they approached a neighborhood gate, he spied a small group of elders chatting. He stood on his litter, nearly toppling off before calling a halt to his servants. "Elders, you! I am Haman. Show this rabble how to treat their masters. Bow to me." It took them a moment to see his robe and react appropriately. They dropped to their knees. Mordecai instinctively began to bow with them. As he bent his knees, his eyes traveled up from the silver hem over the fine blue fabric, landing on the man's face. He recognized Haman. He remembered his friend, Prime Minister Admatha, impaled outside the city walls. He breathed deep, looked square in the face of the new prime minister, rose up straight, and slowly shook his head before he turned and walked away. Haman leapt from the litter, howling as he twisted his ankle. "Stop! Come back and kneel to Persia!" he shouted in vain. As his face burned with rage, he turned to the elders, still kneeling in shock. "Stand up now! Tell me, who is that? How can he refuse to honor my presence?" Haman leaned onto his left ankle, bending down and rubbing his right. "Speak! Answer me!" Gobryas stood up. "Prime Minister, he is Mordecai, a Jew, not a true Persian, it seems." Haman was so angry, he nearly ran back to his home, his servants carrying the litter, barely able to keep up. He ran past his gardens, through the gates, and into his palace. Servants jumped to attention and then were plowed aside until he was gasping and seething in his central courtyard. Zeresh, Haman's wife, came running down from the balcony. "What is it, Haman?" "I am to be respected," he shouted. She stopped and stepped back, bowing her head. "Yes, my husband," she said quietly. "But if the people will not bow for me," he sputtered, "he must pay." Zeresh placed a hand on his shoulder as he recounted Mordecai's insolence. "He's a Jew, you said." Haman was quiet now, as his anger moved deeper into his soul. "Well," Zeresh continued, "let's be done with them once and for all. You're always speaking of your hatred for Abraham's descendants. Avenge Agag and use your power to destroy them." Haman's eyes lit up. His anger fueled his hunger for plotting. He paced the richly tiled floor as he planned. "Yes, yes, I can see it all now. This is perfect." It was a perfect plan. At least, while Haman was blinded by anger, vengeance, greed, hatred, and any other vile motivation left lying about his immense palace, it seemed perfect. His wife had made a good point. Why let anger be wasted? Why not use it to profit? He had finally pulled all the parts of his plan together. He smiled, carrying a silver goblet of wine in one hand and several long, opal-colored dice in his right. "Thank you for coming," he smiled effusively. "Katanes, make sure everyone understands." Katanes was a broad-shouldered, war-fighting noble. He had served under Xerxes in Greece, but he became impatient when a war wasn't being fought. He found Xerxes' grand building and development plans a little boring, but Haman had an exciting plan. "It's simple," Katanes explained. "Persia has many people from many lands spread throughout the empire, but one of these groups of people doesn't truly consider themselves to be Persian. The Hebrews set themselves apart. They hold on to their boring religion, and they profit off of our people. The prime minister will present a decree for the king to sign. This decree will state that all Hebrews in the kingdom are ordered to be killed by all Persians." "Yes," Haman interjected, "but it gets better." He looked at each of the men gathered under his flowering trees. Katanes continued, "And when you kill a Jew, you get to take all of his property as your own." Several men gasped excitedly. The Jews had amassed impressive landholdings across the kingdom. No grand estates or great piles of gold, but land could serve a noble even better at times. A portion would be taxed, of course. This profit should encourage the king to accept their proposal. His palace at Persepolis won't come cheap, after all. Haman nearly jumped. "Just a moment. I have a surprise." All heads turned. "I will pay the tax in advance to the king. How can he turn down 10,000 sacks of silver? And I've done the measurements. I believe with all of you men and all of your fighters, we can easily recover that much by killing more Jews than anyone else." Cheers were raised around the table. Katanes could have his bloodshed, and everyone could have their profit. With a king who was preoccupied with opium and wine and women, and sometimes roads and buildings, they were sure to get their decree. "Just one more thing," Katanes said. "We must determine the date." He picked up the dice Haman had laid on the table. A Zoroastrian magician approached and laid out a chart with all the days of the year on it. Goblet after pitcher of wine disappeared as the magician spent the afternoon rolling those dice hundreds upon hundreds of times. Finally, he stopped. "March 7. That day is the most sure," he said. The men stumbled awake from a long doze. They were clearly disappointed that their payoff would not come for nearly a year. They began to murmur until Katanes stopped them. "That is more time to plan, my friends. And more planning means more profit." And the wine began pouring again. "Killing what? Sure. Here's my ring, Xerxes the First, king of Persia and Media, king of kings and king of nations, could barely be bothered to walk away from the window." Haman just stood in the king's quarters, confused, but also very happy. Xerxes trailed off. I'm not worried about the money or whatever you'd mentioned. He turned, dropped his ring in Haman's hand, and left the room. Haman was very, very happy. He walked to the window and saw a beautiful young woman, softly clothed, walking through the king's private garden. A moment later, he saw the king rushing to the garden. The next day, in the royal scribe's office, Haman pressed the king's ring into the hot wax, sealing decree after decree. The order was carefully written in every language of the kingdom. Outside, dozens of beautiful white horses waited to carry the decree across the empire. At lunchtime, the army of scribes finished their task, and the message went out in a flurry of hoofbeats. The decree was delivered throughout Susa as well, posted at the gates and read aloud. Haman hurried up to the king's private quarters, and they conversed over a lunch of chilled fruit and meat. But outside the palace walls, throughout every quarter of the city, confusion and chaos exploded. In some quarters, Jewish families and shops were attacked by eager plunderers who couldn't wait for March. Then they were fought back by the guards who declared that the decree had a very specific date, and that date had not yet come. In others, Persians mourned and wailed with their Jewish friends, distraught over such a seemingly capricious and violent law. That evening, all across the city, peace disappeared with the setting sun. Mordecai fled the palace. He tore his clothes, covering himself in rags, dirt, and ashes as a symbol of his mourning. He walked all through the night, city gate to city gate, wailing and grieving his people's impending doom. As the sun rose, he finished his walk of travail at the palace gate near his regular station. I'm sorry, Mordecai, you know you cannot enter the palace dressed like that, the guard said. Mirab, I am a Jew, and I am in mourning for my people. I cannot dress for the court, Mordecai replied. I'm sorry, but I cannot let you in. Mordecai sat down on a low planter just outside the gate. Then I will stay here. Let me write a message for Haggai, he ordered. Mordecai sent a message through Haggai to Esther. She did not know of the decree, so at first, when she was told about Mordecai's appearance, she thought that some tragedy had come upon him, and she sent him new clothes, which he refused to wear. But then she read the message. It explained the decree, the terror reigning in Susa, and likely all across the kingdom. It ended with a simple plea. My queen, you must go to the king and beg for mercy for your people. Esther recalled her visit to the throne room. She could see its terrible authority and recall the sight of the criminals hanging from the outer walls of the city after they had been executed. There was certain to be some other way. She could not go into the king. The next day, Haggai ushered her out to the pool by the women's palace. A wall ran along it that abutted some servant entrances to the palace proper. Over here, Haggai pointed. Esther approached a fanciful statue carved into the wall. Esther, listen. She heard Mordecai's voice. He was standing on the other side of the wall, speaking through a small crack at the statue base. She bent down to hear. You must visit the king. You must beg for us. Oh, Mordecai, I am devastated. How could this happen? You know, everyone knows I cannot go to the throne. I would be killed. I haven't even seen him in a month. He has a new young woman from the harem. Oh, Mordecai, there is no more hope. There's nothing. Tears ran down her face as her shoulders shook in sobs. My daughter, Hadassah, listen to me. Her cries softened when he said that name. I love you. You must consider this. Your people, your family will die. God's people will be saved, I'm sure, but we will die if you do not do something. Mordecai's voice stopped for a long moment as he waited for a wagon of rotting food from the palace to travel the alley behind him. Esther, how do we know that you weren't made queen for this very moment? The songbirds chirped in the garden as a small goose splashed in the pool. Smoke rolled over the palace from the kitchen fires. Mordecai coughed on the dust. Esther stood up, pulled the soft veil from her head, wiped the tears from her cheeks, and let it fall into the dirt. Mordecai, Father, do as I say. You and all the Jews in Susa, go outside the western wall, gather by the stream there, fast and pray. Don't drink or eat for 3 days. My women and I will do the same here. After 3 days, I will go to the king. If I live, or if I die, so be it. So 3 days later, at sunrise, Esther was standing looking out at the sky. She had seen days like this before. The sunrise was vibrant. The sky was calm. The air was cool. But beneath the placidness of the morning, she could feel a terrible storm raging inside her. Today could only mean death, but she would face it. "My queen, here, wear this." It was Haggai. She hadn't asked him to come this early, but he was a faithful advisor and friend. She turned to him, trying to hide her shaking hands. He stepped forward with the simple white gown he had given her to wear to the king years ago. She gasped and looked in Haggai's kind eyes. One moment of hope sprung up in her, and each moment after cascaded into a rising well. Tears ran down her face. "Haggai, bless you," she shouted as she rushed forward and embraced him. "My queen," Haggai laughed, "my queen, you will conquer the world in this gown. I will see you soon." Esther's maids dressed her, and Haggai guided her through the women's palace, across the military plaza, through the grand columns of the throne hall, to the tremendous doors before the throne room. "Are you ready?" Haggai asked. She nodded. Haggai motioned to the guards. They began to protest. "But we know the consequences," Haggai said. "Open the doors." And they opened, swinging out and pulling a strong breeze from the throne room into their faces. It smelled of lavender and wine. And inside, nearly 30 men, all in military uniforms or brilliant advisors' robes, spun around with their mouths open. Standing on the top step of the throne platform was Haman, startled out of some speech to the council. He turned, growing red, as he saw the doors opened without command. "Who would interrupt Haman's military, the king's military council? The penalty..." He was cut short as King Xerxes leapt to his feet and approached the edge of the platform. "My queen," he shouted, "Esther." He groped about with his hands for a moment, then grabbed the scepter from Haman and held it towards her. Esther collapsed to the floor, bowing to the king. "Rise," he shouted, bounding down the steps, nearly knocking Haman from the throne. She reached out and touched the scepter. "I'll give you half of my kingdom if you ask for it." "My king," she said as she rose, "I only request that you and Haman join me for a banquet I've prepared today." The council gasped. None of the men in here had ever seen the queen up close before, and now she had invited Haman to a banquet. Haman smiled at them and nearly sprinted out of the palace to prepare as soon as Esther had left. That night, Haman joined the king in the queen's private dining room. Haman made a big production of complimenting the queen's beauty and the feast and mentioning his many accomplishments. When Xerxes finally became bored of conversation, he motioned for Haman to cease. Then he banged his knife on a platter. And when Haman finally stopped talking, he asked Esther, "What do you really want, my queen?" "As I said, even half of my kingdom, I would give it to you." Haman winced at this offer, but he nearly cheered aloud when Esther turned down the offer and said simply, "My king, I just request that you and Haman return for a proper banquet tomorrow evening, and then I will tell you what I want." Haman squared up his shoulders as he walked through the palace. There was no need to doubt it now. Aside from the king, he was the most powerful and important person in the world. And given the lifespan of kings. Well, Haman left the palace through the front gate to meet his servants. Just after he passed through in the square, he saw Mordecai sitting on a bench, dressed in rags and covered in ash and dirt. Mordecai saw him, and staring him down, Mordecai stood up and crossed his arms. Haman began to scream, first in confusion and then in anger. How could this man, this doomed Hebrew, still defy him? But then he laughed slowly and smiled as he left. When he arrived home, he sent out his servants to summon his friends, relatives, debtors, servants, and sycophants. And when they were all gathered in the courtyard inside his home, he stood on the balcony above them and recounted to them his many accomplishments and the great honors given to him of late, and of his private meals with the king and the queen. The crowd reacted approvingly, cooing and gasping at the appropriate moments. But then Haman threw himself against the balcony railing and screamed, "But it all means nothing with that filthy Hebrew sitting at the gate and mocking me." After much consolation and discussion, Haman accepted the party's plan. His servants would set out in the morning to build a sharpened pole 75 feet tall by the city wall. And then he, as the powerful man he was, could simply ask the king to have Mordecai thrown on it. Well, comforted by his dreams of vengeance and acclamation, Haman slept well that night. Xerxes, however, thrashed about on his bed so much that his young new harem girl gave up and left the room. He ordered bread and wine brought to him. He paced about. He counted the stars, but he could not sleep. At a loss, he ordered the official record, the book of the history of King Xerxes' reign, a work that was still in progress, be brought to him, hoping the dry chronicles would put him into a stupor. As he tried to read the charts of financial transactions between his provinces and the correspondences of his satraps, he nearly did fall asleep. But then, just before sunrise, he stumbled onto an account of a plot for his assassination by two eunuchs and found himself more awake and alert than he could remember. What reward did we give this Mordecai? Xerxes asked his attendant. None, my king, he replied. Are any of my advisors in the court this early? Xerxes asked. Yes, only Prime Minister Haram, who arrived very early today. Well, send him in, the king ordered. Haman entered Xerxes' record room, bowing as he approached the disheveled king. Tell me, Haman, what should I do to honor someone with whom I am pleased? Haman smiled, thinking of the pole being built for Mordecai, of the banquet with the queen tonight, of his loyal crowd comforting him, and now the king's plan to honor him. Well, I would dress him in your very robes and place him on one of your personal horses, with your emblem on its head, of course, and have a great noble lead him through the streets. The king stood up, nodding, and have the noble shouting, "This is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor." "Very good," Xerxes said. "Gather everything you need and do this for Mordecai, who sits at the palace gate. Be sure to do exactly as you said." "Excellent. Now leave. I need to sleep." Xerxes fell fast asleep on the cushions by the scroll shelves while Haman set about his unwelcome task. Mordecai and Haman stared each other down for several long minutes at the gate before the guards convinced Mordecai that this was the king's order and explained its purpose. Then Mordecai climbed onto the king's royal horse, a dark black beauty with silver emblem between its eyes, and Mordecai was led through all the gates of the city, fearing for his people's lives and celebrating his strange fortune, wearing royal robes over his tattered sackcloth. It appeared that Haman suffered a painful death every time he cried out, "This is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor." And any time he saw someone he recognized, he wanted to crawl under the horse and hide. When the route finally ended back at the gate, Haman fled for his home, leaving the horse and guard standing there. There, his wife Zeresh shared a revelation. "Haman, you sought to avenge the Amalekites, but now I can see that you will never defeat this Jew. It would mean your death." He was stunned by this pronouncement, but he had no time to question her as the king's men had arrived to take him to the queen's proper banquet. Well, Haman wasn't sure he wanted to attend a banquet that night, seeing the king would only remind him of his humiliating mourning. But Esther's beauty and kindness had a way of softening harsh moods, so as tray after tray of exquisite treats were brought out to the table, Haman lightened. An hour into the meal, new wine was poured. Esther smiled at the king. He leaned back into his cushions. "Esther, now as I have said before, I will give you up to half of my entire kingdom if you only ask. Please, tell me what this is about." Esther pushed her food and drink aside as a darkness crashed over her face. "Yes, my king, if you care for me, and if I have been a pleasure to your days at all, please grant this request." Xerxes leaned forward to listen. "Save my people," she continued. "For one of your court has sold us into death and annihilation. They have given us over to those who would take pleasure in slaughtering us." Xerxes squinted, then stood, shouting in confusion. "What? Your people? How could this happen? Who has done this?" Haman slinked down into his cushions. Esther turned and stared right into him. "This," wicked Haman. He has betrayed my people, the Jews. Xerxes' confusion passed after a moment as he realized what had happened. Then he kicked his goblet off of the low table and screamed. He grabbed the fine silver vases and other pleasing decorations off the table and hurled them at the wall. Haman rolled back away from the table as Xerxes stormed through the patio and out into the garden. Haman had no doubt what was to come. He crawled to Esther. "My queen, my beautiful queen, I had no idea. I would never harm you." He reached his hand and touched her foot as he pleaded, "Spare me, and I'll make sure that you're safe. I'll always be..." Xerxes stormed back into the room. He saw Haman touching the queen and shouted, "Even in my palace, you would dare to touch my queen. Guards!" The guards rushed in and grabbed Haman. With a nod from the king, they covered his face. His fate was made. The king was told of Haman's plans, and he directed Haman be thrown onto the pole that he had made for Mordecai. He passed his ring to Mordecai, along with the robes and position of prime minister, and he passed all of Haman's estate, his land, and wealth to Esther. But there was still much work to do. Persia had a law in place that was intended to prevent hasty decrees. No law that was signed by the king could be rescinded. But with kings like Xerxes, this didn't work very well. Esther and Mordecai worked very hard and found a solution. Mordecai sent out a decree in the king's hand, declaring that on March 7th, all Jews were permitted to defend themselves, and they could take the possessions of any enemies who attacked them. Mordecai stood in the scribe's office as the decrees were prepared in every language of the kingdom. He sealed them with the king's ring and watched as the glorious horses set out faster than his eyes could follow. Throughout the kingdom, when word of Haman's treachery was revealed, and when men heard of Mordecai's elevation, they feared the Jews. So much that some people converted and called themselves Jews. Some of these were genuine, and some were only trying to save themselves. Even with this new decree, however, many throughout the kingdom could not pass up the chance to attack the Jews and to plunder their wealth. When that day came, God protected them as he had countless times before. Throughout the kingdom, 75,000 violent killers were themselves killed as they tried to harm the Jews. Even in Susa, the king's winter capital, 500 men were killed on that day. In fact, the hatred to the Jews that Haman uncovered was so deep that Esther asked the king for a second day to fight off their enemies. And on the next day, they found 300 more men still plotting to kill Jews, and possibly even Esther and Mordecai. When this day passed, they finally rested and gave thanks for their deliverance. Mordecai sent out a message to all Jews to always remember these days and celebrate them with a feast. And nearly 2,500 years later, the Jewish people still celebrate this deliverance in the Feast of Purim, named after the word for the lots that Haman had cast to choose the date. We don't entirely know what happened to Mordecai or Esther after that. The Bible says that Mordecai thrived as the prime minister, managing the affairs of the kingdom and Esther's new wealth. Esther may have been forgotten as the king's attentions drew elsewhere. We know that about 13 years after Esther's coronation, Xerxes was assassinated by Artabanus, his chief bodyguard. It seems that Vashti's son, Artaxerxes, ruled after his death. We know, however, what Scripture wants us to know from this story. That God took a young orphan, he allowed her to go through trying and unpleasant experiences so that in precisely the correct moment, she was ready to save his people. He used the lowly Hadassah, the foreign girl who liked to play by the stream outside the city gates, to make his promise secure. In 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10, it says, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." Your place in this world is not always obvious from such a close-up view. You may seem out of place, without a purpose. You may question and rail against your poor station. But consider that you were chosen by God. And who knows, but that you were placed here today for such a time as this. And that's my telling of the story of Esther. Thanks for Thanks for following along. So does anybody have any thoughts from their reading or from my story? Anything that stood out to you? Laura.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it until I read the NIV about the pole.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of weird.
Dwayne and I were talking about this earlier, a lot of the newer translations, and I think even a lot of the historical research, seems to lean towards the fact that probably it was a pole, that in that time and in the world, I'm not entirely sure about the Persians, but I know in the Ottoman Empire, in the Turkish world, impaling was usually the way that they executed someone. And as I was pointing out to Dwayne, even if you had visited Istanbul during the height of their empire, as you approached the city, you would have seen outside the city wall, built into the wall, spikes probably with criminals impaled on them, so that you knew you had better follow the law while you were inside the gate. So it seems like it probably was thrown onto a pole, probably. And the scripture, it says it was at Haman's palace. He built it in his own courtyard, which tells me that Haman, apparently, he was immensely wealthy. He had a palace with a wall high enough that he could build a 75-foot pole and throw someone onto it. It also struck me, I mentioned to Dwayne, too, it's another occasion where confusion over someone being hanged comes out is in the story of Judas. And in one part it says that he hung himself. Another part it says that he had died, crashed onto the ground. So, you know, we're never exactly sure once we get a few thousand years removed. But either way, he had a despicable plan that he was very excited to enact. I kind of saw, whenever I read Haman, I kind of saw him as someone who really felt that he was the king, that he acted and carried himself in the way. And if you know history, a lot of kings were in that position too, where they relied immensely on the nobles and the people who had the wealth and the men to support them. So in some ways, they might not have been the king, but they still pulled a lot of the strings. And obviously, Haman found himself in a position where he really was the ruler, because Xerxes was not a good leader. It seems like he was very, his attentions came and went. He could have someone sign off on the death of an entire ethnic group in his kingdom without even blinking an eye, but he would become very upset if you touched his queen. I would not have wanted to serve as an advisor in his court, I do not think. Does anyone have any other questions or thoughts? Anything that really, when you read through it this week, that really stood out to you, something that you forgot or something you didn't realize was in the story? For me, yes.
I think just fasting and praying, like, I know the right power of that, and yet then hearing it again in this story, it was like, wow, that moves nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, it is like we so forget that, and the power of fasting and praying, and to have a whole ethnic group
right
fasting and praying for this, it was like,
yeah,
wow. I mean, there's no way it couldn't happen.
Yeah.
God's going to make that happen because it honors us.
Yeah. And I don't know how many Jews lived in Susa at the time, but it seems like it probably was a fair number. And so she told him, take all of them and pray. And it's been pointed out before in the book of Esther, there's no explicit mention of God. There's no explicit description of Mordecai or Esther's faith of their adherence to the Jewish laws. We don't really know. We don't know how devout they were. We don't know if they came to a point. So in my story, I kind of told it as the point that they had kind of drawn back from that, but whenever they were forced to make a decision, they embraced their faith. They embraced their heritage and their identity. But the time when Esther tells him to take 3 days to fast, it doesn't say pray. However, there really is no other time that we have recorded in Jewish history where anyone ever went and fasted without praying. So the implication seems pretty clear that she was telling him, you need to go pray, and we'll do the same. And so she gathered all of her maids, probably of many different faiths, but she, it seems, instructed them to do the same and honor her faith, and they joined her. You might notice some character differences in here. Some of them weren't named. One thing, I kept Haggai, who was in the first part of the story, who befriended Esther, just because it gets a little cumbersome to introduce a massive cast of characters. And I like that he really, he showed her kindness before and that he could continue to show her kindness. Those men, those eunuchs and those advisors, we don't know what their nationality is either. Some of those may have been Hebrew. Whenever a king would conquer a nation, a lot of times he didn't just take the money and the possessions that he liked, he took the people that he liked. So an advisor to the king could have very well been pulled into his palace and been instructed to take care of the harem or take care of, you know, the city structures or something. So God had his people all through the Persian Empire, and Haman somehow thought at the height of his arrogance that he could get all of them. And in the end, it seems like he got none of them. So it's a fun story for that. We like to see our villains climb up to the height of their ego and then come crashing down. I think one thing that really stood out to me that was different was the fact that we don't know much about their faith. We don't know much about Mordecai's and Esther's motivation. We don't know for sure if they were told there would be a great competition to see who would be queen and if they went there willingly, or if the king's men came and said, "You've been chosen, come to the palace." We don't really know. There's so many things, but like I mentioned, we know the most important parts. We know what Scripture wanted us to know. And that's what's great about the story. If you pick up the Bible and you're not initiated, you don't know it, it seems like it could be a very boring book and very dense and hard to get into. But this story was in there. And there are hundreds of other fascinating stories with very real people who had very real fears and doubts and challenges that God used for specific purposes. And the story, a story like Esther, it's actually one of the more well-developed stories told in a narrative form in the Bible. It's almost like reading a novella. But even in that form, it's very basic storytelling. And so I can imagine that a Jewish community, hundreds of years after the event, gathering around and telling the story to their children at the feast, I can imagine 1,000 years later singing a song about it, doing plays about it. Movies have been made. People have written stories that it's told in such a way that we can understand it in whatever medium that we currently know. And for us, I think today that's novels, films, television shows. That's the way we can kind of understand stories. So I think it's just fascinating. So I'm glad that you guys read through Esther. If you haven't, take another chance. Read it this week. And maybe start scoping out some other stories in the Bible that you know a little bit about, but you'd like to know a little bit more. I'm going to do the same, and sometime in the future, I'll have another story of someone else. I'm not sure who yet, but there's a wealth of them. Well, thanks everyone for listening this morning. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information about Living Faith, check us online at living.com.